Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It doesn't matter what notes are being played. And I think, you know, notes are incredibly important.
I'm just going to say, I love musical notes.
Yeah, yeah. what a ridiculous thing for me to say. But
welcome to Pocket Buds, a back pocket podcast where I talk to my best buds about video games and stuff. This week, we're talking about the music of video games. It's hard to remember a time where video games weren't accompanied with a soundtrack. Some of the first games had none at all. Do you remember the original Pong theme? Of course you don't. It didn't have one. Don't be ridiculous. It didn't take very long for game developers to realize that something was missing. However, when it came to the sort of technology that would put a little ditty in a game, the options were limited to sound chips like programmable sound generators and FM synthesis. It was from these chips that tunes were born, and thus began the age of chiptune. In 1975, Gunfight released with an opening chiptune theme, being the first to do so. And then in 1978, Space Invaders was the first game to have a continuous background music motif. Sure, it was just four notes that got faster and faster, which definitely wouldn't send someone crazy or anything, but it was a big deal at the time, and we have Tomohiro Nishikado to thank for both of those.
Thank you!
It wasn't until 1980 that we'd see the first game to feature ongoing melodic background music, that game being Namco's Rally X, released in 1980 for arcades. But of course, Rally X just had one track that played over and over. Sure, it banged, but it was just one track. Over time, with more advancements in technology, games would release with sometimes eight or more tracks. Konami's Frogger in 1981 went completely insano style with at least 11 different gameplay tracks. 11! Can you believe it? But hey, if I went over the history of video game music technology with a fine-tooth comb, we'd be here all day, or week even, and we're both busy people, you and I. So instead of looking at the whatsits and doodads that make it work, let's look at some of the general areas of video game music. You've got your iconic soundtracks made for the game itself. It's hard to pass up the timeless work of Nintendo composer Koji Kondo, who had pretty much been credited for composition in every single first-party Nintendo game since 1984. That guy really knows how to make a classic, and we'll be talking more about him later. Then there's the tireless work of Nobuo Uematsu, who is best known for his work on the Final Fantasy series. This guy not only worked on every Final Fantasy game with Square Enix from 1985 to 2004, but when he left the company and started his own label, he was still doing stuff freelance style for Square Enix after that. This guy loves Final Fantasy. Plus, he also wanted to become a professional wrestler at some point, which is very cool to me. And then you've got your games with licensed soundtracks too. Everybody loves the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater soundtracks, and everybody's got a favorite radio station to listen to in the Grand Theft Auto games. And now Fortnite Festival exists, you can drop Peter Griffin out of the battle bus and make him sing Buddy Holly by Weezer when he hits the ground. Aren't games magical? Do you remember the first time you heard a song in a video game that really connected with you? I do. It was when I was just a little kid playing The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker for the first time, and I would find myself constantly returning to my grandma's house. Sure, it may have been because I was riddled with guilt for losing my sister to Big Bird, but there was something so comforting about grandma's theme playing in the background, like a warm bowl of goulash, just like Baba makes. In my eyes, video games need music. Anytime I'm playing a game where there isn't music playing, I'm often wondering, where's the music? It's like my own personal Poochie situation.
Whenever Poochie's not on screen, all the other characters should be asking, where's Poochie? Three.
Great.
If you can't tell, I'm a strong appreciator of video game music. While I could sit here all day and talk about it, I thought it might be better to talk about it with someone who's not just as passionate as me, if not more so, but has even dabbled in the world of video game composition himself. So joining me today to talk about the wonderful world of video game music and what makes a composition for games memorable is Deputy Chair of Media and Communication at Swinburne University, the host of Screen Sounds on ABC Classic, and award-winning video game composer and journalist, Dan Golding. Dan, how you going?
I'm good. It's really nice to be joining you. I think it... Like the Agdas last year, you were like, hey, you should come on the podcast. I was like, yeah,
I was.
Sure.
I was. I think I saw you. I'm like, come on that podcast right now. I mean, it's the best place to kind of meet people in the industry, no doubt. Mm. But on top of that, I like went and was like, come on my podcast. And then left it being like, oh my God. I just spent a night talking about my podcast. it feels like over for me.
you spend a night talking about your podcast at a games event. What?
I mean, wild. It could be worse. I could be talking about like layoffs.
Yeah, I don't think we were talking about them at that stage, were we? It was a slightly different games industry in a way.
But it was like, actors were Melbourne Games Week, and I think a good amount of layoffs had already happened, and nobody wanted to say anything.
That's right.
Which is like realistically, nobody wants to say anything. It's like, yeah, fair enough. Like, I get it. But you know, there's this like real stinky, huge elephant in the room right now.
It's true. I remember actually the one time where the elephant got mentioned. Yeah, Jack from SMG was on stage, accepting an award, and was like, "Yeah, it's sad. All my colleagues had to lose their jobs."
Yeah, it's sad. I don't work here anymore.
Yeah, yeah, that was quite something. God.
Yeah, it was. It's just bad. The end. Mm. It's just bad.
Yes.
The end.
It is.
What's good is. The world that exists within video games, be it, you know, the games themselves and like the art of them, the gameplay aspects of them, the sound design and, of course, the music is good, right? You know, there's so much value within that. And, you know, you have kind of seen it from a lot of different angles. Like you've had your fingers in so many pies, so many pies. Mm-hmm. So I thought we'd start with, you know, your work in media. You're a book man, you're a journalism man, also academia man, but we'll get to that later. How do you think your work in the media deepened your understanding of like the games industry and video game music, if at all?
Yeah, so much. I mean, that's where I started. I guess, of all the many things that I do, I don't really describe myself as a journalist anymore because other things have really taken over. And, you know... Being a freelance journalist is possibly even harder than working in the games industry, as you may know something about that. So back in the day, I think the first games thing I ever did was I went to the Free Play Independent Games Festival and kind of spoke on a few panels, and then eventually like kind of wrote about it, I think. And then kind of fell into writing about games for a really tiny little like indie games journalism site, which no longer exists. But, you know, they paid 1 cent a word. So I was rolling in it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, like it's indie. So like sure. But
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Swimming pools of cash. And but yeah, like I did work for Crikey, most famous for being sued by the Murdoch family, which is, you know, was its vibe back then as well. And I think that kind of bled into my games industry reporting and being a little bit more bolshy, can we say, than usual.
Yeah.
But then moved to the ABC and did a fair bunch. And I got to say, like, I mean, that was my entry into games. And I feel like I learned a lot about the people that make games and, you know, the issues that they face and the audiences for games. I've gone down that path. I was like, should I mention Gamergate? It's like 10 years ago, but like I was oh my God.
Hey, yeah. If anything, now's the perfect time to talk about
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was a trial by fire and I was kind of, you know, there for a lot of that. But that's maybe even a whole different podcast. So I learned a lot about all of that before I started making stuff for games. I kind of, you know, thought of myself as an outsider in many ways. And I guess because of games, music, still think of myself as kind of, I don't know, not an outsider, but parallel to the industry in many ways. Not to jump ahead too much, but in this research report that me and some colleagues have done recently, we describe games composers as Venn diagram workers, as like people who kind of fall between two industries and don't really fit into either. They're both part of the music industry and the games industry, but also not really part of the music industry and not really part of the games industry. They're kind of in between. And so even though I've shipped, I think, like, 8 games, worked on games that have been published. I did air quotes for listeners, sorry.
Yeah, like the confidence is not quite there to say that you were a part of the shipping.
Yeah.
Even though you were.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I still kind of feel like, you know, my day-to-day is not the games industry. I've always been an observer and a commenter and a thinker about games and, yeah, kind of a maker of a part of games. But it kind of feels parallel in a way.
Oh, absolutely. And I totally get where you're coming from. Obviously, I don't have the kind of vast background of experience that you've had, but I totally understand being in that weird space of feeling like you are both in and out of the games industry, but also neither at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like you're haunting the games industry almost, like a ghoul.
Yeah.
But it's actually really interesting that you mention the video game music and being a video game composer kind of exists in this weird Venn diagram because, you know, you work in academia. Like I know that you've been involved in quite a few research papers about, you know, video game music and stuff. And I've seen like from my experience at uni, I tried to do game development stuff. I did some music composition stuff, but there's not really a path for video game music composition academically, you know, unless you're analyzing it and researching it to actually compose for video games is not really something that you're seeing at unis. And do you think there'll be a world eventually where video game music as a craft will kind of become more prevalent in academia? Like where would it go?
Yeah.
You know, would it go in game dev? Would it go in music composition?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. Where would it go, right? I mean, this is kind of the question for a lot of things. I mean, universities are the product of the Middle Ages, like quite seriously, you know. In the UK with Oxford and Cambridge, that's why we still wear those funny hats. I've got a hat from when I graduated my PhD that looks straight out of a Renaissance fair.
Love that.
And so, you know, like all of these things, especially newer disciplines, even something like film kind of, you know, was ad hoc thrown between like design schools and like literature for a little while and stuff like that. So like this is a thing. But, you know, like in Australia at the moment, we'd surveyed, you know, who's making music for games in Australia. And, you know, there were more than we thought there would be. We received more meaningful responses to our survey, you know, which is, I guess, really all you can do than we thought. It was like 90 or thereabouts of people who responded, which is, you know, quite a few for Australia for a small smaller industry like Australia, you know, obviously a much smaller percentage of that were people who were actually kind of, you know, paying the rent or the mortgage from this.
Yeah.
So like, there are small areas of study. I spoke to some people at the Sydney Conservatorium when I was last up in Sydney, who do like one unit of study about kind of interactive music composition and games and stuff like that. So there are some stuff already. I know there's some stuff on that at the Victorian College of the Arts here in Melbourne. Mm. I teach people how to think about music for screen more broadly. So those all those kinds of areas. But I mean, I think just the sheer numbers, like it would be kind of irresponsible to offer a whole like degree pumping out 100 students a year if there's only like 92 people or whatever actually doing it. But, you know, at the same time, like I think it's only natural that in Australia, where you do have historically a really strong music industry, you know, and a really kind of independent and fiercely independent music industry and a independent games industry, you know, that people should cross between the two and find interesting ways of collaborating. I mean, you know, you only need to look at like Montaigne finding their home and Stray Gods, you know, going from music industry yeah. success to games industry success. It makes sense. And I got to say, yeah. you know, a lot of the time people talk about games as though it's a subset of screen industries. It often gets lumped into that label with like film and TV. And certainly there are many things that are similar there. But I reckon actually the problems that are faced by the music and the games industries are much more aligned and the kind of solutions.
Totally.
Questions about sustainability, discoverability, right? How do you get people to listen to your music? How do you get people to buy your game?
Play your game.
Yeah. And, yeah. you know, those kind of questions about platform holders, whether it's Spotify or Steam, you know, they're actually pretty similar kind of discussions that are slightly different from, say, Netflix and Steam. That is a little bit of a different kind of situation. You don't just whack your film on Netflix without any discussion going on, whereas you can kind of do that yeah. with Steam and with Spotify. So yeah.
if you got a spare $100, you're all sweet.
Exactly. So I think, you know, I'm not sure academic pathways are going to be a major thing. They'll continue to be there and hopefully yeah. continue to be strengthened. But I mean, the other thing is, you know, I mean, this is the first question that I get pretty much when I do any sort of public talk is how do I start making music for games? And like,
yeah.
the worst thing about being asked that is that I don't really have a good answer, because the answer for me and the answer for almost everybody that we spoke to as part of our research is they had the right conversation at the right time with the right person who was like, hey,
it's luck.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I never set out thinking, yeah, I'm going to become a games composer. I was running Free Play. I mentioned Free Play attending it before. I ended up running it for a couple of years. And we did an event with House House, who were doing developing Push Me Pull You at that time. And there was, you know, when you do an event where there's a public play of a game, there's a lot of waiting around for things to happen.
Yeah.
And I was waiting around chatting with them and I was like, what are you going to do for music? And they were like, I don't know. Had a few ideas, but nothing really solid. And I was like, I reckon I could probably do something. And the next day I was a games composer. So
yeah, sometimes it just happens like that. Mm. It's funny that you mention the similarity between the music industry and the video game industry, especially in Australia. I feel like that is so true. Like, especially with more recently, you know, it's so hard to kind of break out as an Australian artist.
Yeah.
Like, obviously there's still the rules for radio broadcasts. I think it's like 50% of artists you play. Is it just the ABC?
I think that's just the ABC. I think the commercial networks have requirements, but it's self-regulated and lower is my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's 50% have to be Australian artists, right? And that being said, I love Triple J Unearthed. Big fan. I think it's a really good system. That being said, I think a lot of the quota is done through that and that maybe doesn't get as much airtime as it deserves. And you've also got these community radio stations where they're also trying to hit that quota, But they don't. And so much Australian music and so many Australian musicians who are wanting to branch out and get their music out there don't and find it really, really hard to. And then it's hard to tour internationally. It's expensive. It's expensive to tour nationally, you know, and so many festivals are shutting down. Like shit's kind of making it harder and harder to be able to justify music as a career. And you could say the exact same thing about the video game industry, you know, like you do have these marketplaces where you are able to put your games out there, but they are just flushed. They are absolutely flushed. And a big part of getting your game out there is marketing, and marketing's expensive. And there are bigger games that have a lot bigger budgets to have their games marketed over yours. And in Australia as well, like we're doing better with funding, but it's not enough. And there are so many parallels there. So
yeah, like simply making the thing is not enough.
No.
You could make the best game in the history of the universe, but if nobody knows about it, it's not going to make you enough money for you to make the next game. And the same, you could, I think it, to some degree, it's even worse with music. You could seriously, with the technology that's available now, you could make the greatest album in the history of the universe quite plausibly. And, you know, you might get 1,000 plays on Spotify and it's maybe just your mum. Like it's
and your mum loves that.
Yeah. Exactly. And she should. But it's, you know, it's really, really hard to be heard. And, you know, then you have all these kind of similar kind of associated industries that spring up.
Yeah.
Like someone who's like, hey, give me a pocket of cash and I know how to get games journalists or influencers increasingly to play your game. Mm. Or I know how to get your music in front of the Spotify playlist curators because that's where the big cash is for an unsigned, undiscovered artist or whatever. I did the air quotes again. and so, you know, there are all these kind of, you know, middleware, yeah, I guess let's call them that, people who offer these services, which, you know, may or may not actually work, which, you know, probably leads me to my most radical opinion, which is that actually, although it's great to fund all these programs for artists, and it is, obviously, it's great, and it's great that governments provide support for, you know, here's how to learn how to be a marketer, here's how to get your music out there via social media, all these sorts of things. These programs are great. But actually, the best thing that the government could do to increase art and culture in Australia is raise the unemployment benefits, you know, like Centrelink payments, because like...
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah. Absolutely. Raising the rate would solve, I mean, just outside of arts and culture, solve so many things. But to be very specific with that, if people can afford to survive, they can afford to make beautiful things, you know? If you don't have to worry about what you're going to eat, if you're not at risk of being kicked out of your house because you can't afford rent, you're much more likely to be in a great place to make something magical, you know? That's such a huge thing.
And at the moment, there are people who aren't making money from their craft who can afford to do that, and that's people who have, you know, well-to-do life circumstances, you know, and that just basically means that art and culture become increasingly the domain of people who are wealthy, which, sure, wealthy people can create art, but they shouldn't be the only people who can create art.
It's very respectful of you. I think wealthy people shouldn't create art. I think they need to stop making stuff. I don't think it's informed and I don't think it's interesting.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, you know, yeah, I, you know, it, as you say, like the kind of challenges that people are talking about, the kind of life experiences that people are talking about, who are the kinds of people who don't have to worry about the cost of living, maybe aren't that universal, you know, maybe aren't that resonant.
I think art isn't just relatability, but being able to see yourself in art, I think is not necessary, but it is such a big part of it as well.
But it's also, you know, I totally agree with that. But I think the other side of that coin is that actually the most important thing about art is to learn about people who aren't you.
Oh, totally.
Absolutely. So, you know, and I say this as a straight white man, that actually, you know, it has been incredibly important to my life to learn about more marginalized experiences by watching movies, reading books, listening to music produced by those people. Mm. And so, you know, I actually think that it, even more important, you know, of course I would say this being a straight white guy, but more important than seeing yourself in media is actually learning about other people and the diversity of experiences in the world.
Art is one of the beacons of bringing empathy out of you, I feel.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it is an empathy machine. And kind of moving into your work in non-game music as well, I need to ask this because, like, I did do research and I there was one thing that just didn't have a lot of leads that I was kind of really confused by, but, like, I was like, no, surely I'll find something. And I kept Googling and I went on Bing because maybe Google just wasn't being reliable. I went on DuckDuckGo. I was like, I need to find the links here. And I'm finding nothing but a reference on a Wikipedia page that said citation needed. So I have to ask, were you in Dilly All-Stars?
Yeah, I was. Okay. Can you publish this podcast so it can be the citation that citation needed?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were in Dilly All-Stars. Please tell me about that.
Yeah, yeah. So all through undergrad at uni, I was in this band called the Dilly All-Stars, which were, you know, kind of really significant historically before I joined. This is not me bragging. I joined when they were already a band with some importance, and you know, maybe I wasn't there for the peak of them. But basically, this is a group of Timorese people who were mostly refugees to Australia as a result of the invasion of Timor by Indonesia in the 1970s. And then the violence around the independence struggles, and then the referendum for independence in the 1990s. And they were a band that was created in particular by an Australian guy as well, called Paulie Stewart, whose brother was one of the Balibo Five, which, if you haven't heard of the Balibo Five, there were five Australian journalists who this is established fact. I'm not, you know, they were murdered by the Indonesian military.
Right.
For reporting on the events of the invasion in the 1970s. So Paulie's brother was a cameraman working for, I think, Channel 7 or Channel 9, Channel 9, I think. And he died, I think he was like 19.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The events of that was turned into a film called Balibo about, I don't know, 10 years ago. It starred a very, very young Oscar Isaac before he was Oscar Isaac in capital letters.
Yeah.
So this band was a very political band was involved in kind of bolstering the independence movement. They had students smuggle tapes of independence-themed songs into Timor for people to listen to. And then they played in the, whenever it was, maybe the early 2000s, the actual independence celebrations they played as part of that with like Kylie Minogue and stuff. It's like 500,000 people in the audience. Pretty amazing stuff. And then a couple of years later, I joined.
You're like, yeah, good work.
You really
made something. You mind if I just...
Exactly. Yeah. They are still going. They've had some long periods of hiatus. But basically, I was on bass for them for a long time and sometimes miscellaneous other instruments, mostly on bass. Then really when I started my PhD, I was kind of like, something has to go in my life. So I stopped performing.
Right. Did you learn anything from being in a political ska reggae band that you took with you to video game composition?
The Push Me Pull You soundtrack uses a whole variety of genres, but one of which is a kind of Brazilian bachata style beat. I was very heartened to see on YouTube like that track was posted and someone from Brazil had posted like, oh my God, this is actually really authentic music. I was like, yes.
Oh, love that.
Sorry, the link being that in Timor, because Timor was colonized by the Portuguese, right. I should say, they speak Tetan, which is the indigenous Timorese language, but they also predominantly speak Portuguese, and so does Brazil. Right. So there's a lot of kind of intercultural links. And actually I ended up learning Brazilian for 3 years at like night school, just because I went to Europe as like a Australian backpacker and came back feeling embarrassed that I only spoke English. But I knew I had friends who spoke Portuguese, so I have like a low level conversational ability and speak with a broad accent from Rio because that's where my teacher was from.
No, that's great. Well, no, I totally get how that feels, because when I went to Croatia in 2019. I was having dinner with my cousin and some of his friends, and they're all Croatian. And, you know, they asked if I spoke it in Croatian. And I was like, yeah, like a little bit. I was like, samo malo, a little bit. And they were like, oh, you know, that's so good. And they were, you know, it was like, oh, good job. Oh, that's so good. You're so good at that. And then I asked them if they spoke anything else, and all of them spoke at least four languages, and I was so fucking embarrassed. I was like, "Oh, I'm a baby." Okay.
Yeah. Oh, man. It is completely wild, and that actually, you know, in a way, that to the screen soundtrack teaching that I do, because, like, actually, you know, I also teach, you know, not just music but sound.
Yeah.
And sort of speaking to students and say, oh, you know, so like what language do they speak in Spain, you know, and therefore what language do they make movies in Spain? And everybody's obviously, I think, like Spanish. And it's like, well, yeah, they speak Spanish, but there's also like at least three other languages, including in Barcelona, where they don't speak Spanish really primarily. It's some Catalan, I think, in Catalan, Castilian. Oh, yeah. I always get them confused. In Brazil. In Brazil. God. We've been around the world too many times in this conversation already. In Barcelona. And it's like, you know, I think this Australian conception of Europe from afar as being like, you know, obviously just tightly defined by borders is just not true. Like Italy and Germany weren't even countries until like the second half of the 19th century. Like Australia as a nation is like 30 years older than Italy, and that means that, like, you know, there are all these different languages that are spoken in Italy and Germany in particular, not to mention, you know, India. You know, the Netflix sensation is the Hindi dubbed version. It's not even in its original language. So it's like there are many languages in Europe, and rarely, you know, except for England, usually rarely actually defined by the borders. The borders that we see from afar here.
Yeah, totally. And so, when it comes to your work in the composition world, it's too basic a question to ask what is your favorite soundtrack that you've worked on. So instead, I'd like to ask, what soundtrack have you worked on that you felt to be kind of the most creatively challenging for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think there's a couple of ways of answering this. Untitled Goose Game was a real technical challenge, and really pushed my boundaries in terms of that, because you know, my musical training, if you want to say that, I mean, is like only up to year 12. Like a lot of people assume I must have, like, you know, I've got a PhD, so it must be in music. But no, it's completely not that. It was in video games, but it wasn't in music. Like I've got year 12 classroom music basically. but I'm at home with.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things.
Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
It's music. Music is fine.
Yeah.
But dynamic music, you know, like making a soundtrack that really responds to what the player is doing,
yeah,
is something that like we were making up as we went along. And I've since discovered is actually the case for a lot of people. Like, you know, unless you're working in a AAA studio, like in Canada, that's got like 20 years of experience with this. Like, you know, like they actually a lot of the time, and this is true of all game dev, I think, is, you know, a lot of people assume that everyone else out there has the answers and the systems and the practices that like, oh, it's obvious, just do it like X. And, but actually everyone else is just like making it up. Anyway, so we made it up, and that was really technically challenging, and I'm still really, 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 really satisfied with the result. I think Frog Detective 3, I really put like my musical heart and soul into that game. It's got like double the music of the previous two games put together, I think. The title track is all acoustic, so a lot of video games produced in Australia, but certainly the first two Frog Detective games, and most of the third still using like virtual instruments, like digital kind of simulations of instruments. But the title track for Frog Detective 3 is just like all me on double bass and piano and trumpet and some very poor saxophone playing, but you know, and you know, there's a song in that game which is sung by Grace Brooksner, the developer, which, you know, or the creator really of Frog Detective, which I just love. I love that there could meaningfully have been like a best song in an Australian Video Game Award over the last couple of years, like between that and like Stray Gods. I think there was even another one that I was like, what? So many people are doing like songs in their video games these days, which is amazing.
It's awesome.
And but then as well, like the most recent one that I've done, Mars First Logistics, like in a technical sense wasn't challenging because Ian McLarty, the developer, gave me the greatest brief ever, which is we want, you know, songs for the game. I mean, with this kind of immersion discussion with him, but they're songs, they're written like songs. So I could finally sit down and write, you know, nothing that had to loop, nothing that had to be dynamic, just tunes. And that was so incredibly liberating for me because, you know, finally you could do all the songwriting tricks of like intros, outros, modulations, bridges, you know, all these things which you don't often get in video game music because they're really hard to loop. If you change key, you either have to do some funny technical stuff behind the scenes to get that to then change back, or you just have to write it long enough so that it modulates back to the original key before looping around in the audio file. So like, that was really, really fun, and I still really love like pretty much every track on that soundtrack. So I don't know. That's like a real non-answer, but those three were really creatively challenging and interesting in different ways. Yeah,
that was literally an answer. Like you answered. I asked a question, and like you answered it. The only thing was that you answered with more than one, and like that's fine because like they are completely different challenges, which I think is really neat. And I actually would really love to ask about Untitled Goose Game, just because I find the concept of a dynamic soundtrack so fascinating, so fascinating. What goes into making a soundtrack dynamic and making music that responds to what the player does? Because that was arguably like, I mean, I loved a lot about Untitled Goose Game, obviously, but as you know, an audio student myself, there is nothing I love more than music responding to the things that you do. What goes into the creation of that?
First of all, I meant to say before, and I'm just going to say now before I forget, you should totally make a soundtrack one day, Ruby.
I'd love to.
So let me just say that first and foremost. So as I said, like none of us really knew. We just assumed it was like some dark art out there that like mysterious tech imaginings that everybody knows. And like, yeah, there are definitely ways, right? Like in so the common middleware that's used for game music is like WISE or WISE. I hear people pronounce it different ways. It's WISE with an extra W at the front. Untitled Goose Game uses FMOD. But there are ways in both of those systems where you could basically have like a MIDI system, so just basically put in music using MIDI, which is kind of just computer notation. You know what MIDI is, but for the listeners,
yeah,
if you don't, and have essentially that middleware create a system where the computer plays that music, relating to a whole system of programmed events, or perhaps an algorithm. But we didn't want to do that because we. Well, firstly, I think probably none of us really knew how, but also I think because we really wanted to retain that human sense of performance,
yeah,
rather than a set of instructions for the computer to play. And so that's what it is in the end. So basically I did arrangements of these Debussy preludes, which were written in like 1909 to 1912. And then I performed two versions of them, one which is broadly similar to what you would hear if you went to a concert of these pieces. And then the other, which is really different, like much, much slower, much lower energy. There are some moments where I've lowered the notes to take the brightness of them, or perhaps taken them up the octave to give it a little bit more of an excited feel or something like that, but generally lower energy.
Yeah.
And with some sections, you know, kind of cut out and removed. There's one of the preludes, which in a concert setting, there's like an extended quotation of God Save the Queen. We thought that would be probably a little bit too distracting for the player. So I took that out. But basically then, you know, we wanted these to play while the player was playing. And we knew what we were aiming for, which really helped in that we were looking for that kind of silent movie experience where a pianist is watching what's happening on the screen and kind of improvising a soundtrack. And so we knew what we kind of wanted it to sound like. So that actually helped enormously in kind of reverse engineering. How do we get that? So in the end, after a lot of trial and error, I cut up all of the recordings of those preludes into really short segments. Originally, I went through and I cut them up to be like what you would do if you were kind of like a musicologist doing an analysis of phrases, right? Which is what it originally made sense to me as a musician. I was like, well, you can't just stop a phrase mid-performance. You have to at least finish the thought before moving on. But that didn't work in the game at all because it was way too long. Like we're talking like 6, sometimes even 12 seconds of music, which if you imagine a little bit of gameplay, like you're the goose, you're sneaking along, then you do something aggressive, but like 6 seconds later, the music changes to aggression. So what I ended up doing was, after lots of trial and error, honestly, I basically closed my eyes and cut up everything, every beat, which was brute force, but, you know, with a few adjustments, basically worked, which was astonishing. So it means that actually most of those little segments where the game can either choose to start playing or stop playing, or to move between that normal performance and the much more slower energy performance, the decision time, the time for that music to change can be like 0.2 of a second. So it means that, like, as well, there's a lot of audio files. I think for the first prelude, which is the one you hear at the start of the game with the gardener, it's like a normal performance of that would be about 2.5 minutes. And we cut that up. I think it's about, I can get the exact number if I hunt through my hard drive, but it's about 360 times, 370 different cuts.
Oh my God.
And that's the same for both performances.
Wow.
It actually, it means that practically speaking, every performance of the game is different.
Audibly.
Yeah, practically speaking, there's an infinite amount of variation. I got some maths people. I'm not a maths people, but I got some maths people to help with the calculations. And basically, I think I ended up figuring out that if you started Untitled Goose Game just playing the possible variations of that first prelude without silence from the start of the Big Bang, we would be almost finished the first prelude, I think, by about now. So,
My days.
There's a lot. There's a lot of possibilities.
I feel like a mathematical equation like that is only really done. So, one, it can be done, and then immediately after that, you're like,
yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I did that.
Yep.
Yeah. That's a successful win by me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I find your work very, very fascinating because it feels like with every game that you've worked on, they all feel so unique to those games, you know? But I also really admire your work on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to research and your in-depth analysis of video game music because how it works and what goes into it, but also what it brings out of the game that is, I think, is great. So I think something that I'm really interested in when it comes to video game music is memorability. And I feel like even though, you know, Debussy is a guy that already exists and he made that music, but like I feel like in Untitled Goose Game, thanks to the dynamicness, that's not a word.
Sure. It can be a word.
But we'll use it. The dynamicness of the soundtrack, it was memorable in its execution, right? Yeah. And I think memorability of video game soundtracks, it's a topic that I find very interesting, you know? And I think I actually have asked you before on the Powerhouse panel what makes a video game soundtrack memorable. So I'm not going to ask that. But I will ask from, you know, your personal research and, you know, just your personal interest, how do you think that the memorability of video game soundtracks has held up over time? Do you think we still have those soundtracks that stick with you for life coming out regularly?
It's a really interesting question because I think there's a few different ways you can answer this. In music theory, particularly in kind of like soundtrack theory, there's this idea of a topic, which I think is, I increasingly go back to this idea where it's about, if a hero appears on screen, right, in a movie, you kind of know stereotypically what that's going to sound like. Doesn't even really matter what the notes are. There's a musical topic, and that topic is probably going to be brass, a trumpet, da-da-da-da, you know.
Yeah.
Or if there's a romantic scene, you know there's going to be lush strings, you know, pulling at the heartstrings, right? Sobbing musical instruments. And that's what we call a musical topic, where it's not about the notes. It's not even about the piece of music. It's about the sounds that is associated with that moment. And I think, you know, video games have been really powerful for doing that kind of thing over the years. But your question of do we still have those kind of soundtracks, I think, yeah, it's an interesting thing to consider because previously when video game music hardware was much more limited, you had a much smaller palette to work with. You couldn't have strings for a romantic scene. You know, you couldn't have brass for a hero because everything kind of sounded like 8 or 16-bit beeps and bloops.
Oh, yeah, you had PSGs and you had FM transmitters.
Exactly. Which in its own way became that kind of musical topic in that if you watch a TV show and a video game comes on, still today, you know there's like a producer who wants to have it kind of sound like beep, beep,
beep, beep. They're like, I'm putting chiptune on this right now.
Yeah, exactly. Even if it's clearly not a chiptune era game. Because that's what video games sound like.
Yeah.
Sound like, air quotes again. But like, you know, I think how composers compensated for that in the old days is by making music that was really memorable in different ways. I mean, Mario is such a good example of this, where like you think of the famous World 1-1 melody bit of music, it's like doing all these really unusual things, these skipping, hopping rhythms that's kind of a bit ragtime, kind of a bit almost bossa nova, right? Where it's like all these, I won't get into the technical stuff because it's not a music podcast, but the rhythms are over the beats, you know? Like if you were da 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 dun 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 da da, it's all pushing against that beat.
Yeah.
It's over the top of the beat. It's really falling on that beat. And that's because that's how you get memorable music out of limited hardware in that case.
It almost, to me, feels like big band decomposed. It feels like the original Mario music feels like it was made for a big band and then just pulled back as much as they could.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like that's the case for all of the Mario music. I mean, Koji Kondo was like a flipping genius, but, you know, like he's working within all these different kind of like weird styles and just getting a sense of fun, I think, through that music, which has resulted in iconography. And we don't even need to get onto the conversation about how the sound effects are built into the same set of hardware. But anyway, I think Zelda is actually a really good example of this because as the actual hardware and software that's been used to create the music and more importantly, get the music onto the game and into people's homes has improved, the reliance on those big recognizable moments of music has shifted a little bit. Breath of the Wild, you know, as much as I love the Breath of the Wild soundtrack, it's much, much more reliant on kind of subtle ambience. You know, there was always the moment in the previous Zelda games where it's like, wow, I'm in Hyrule Field, and the big fanfare is like, dun, da, 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 da. It's not there in Breath of the Wild, really.
Yeah.
Tears of the Kingdom has a little bit more of that, I'd say, particularly in, I can never say it, Caligera boss battle. Amazing.
Yeah. It's so funny that you mentioned Zelda because, one, it was another question I was going to ask, but two, it's a conversation that I've had before when it comes to Zelda, very specifically Breath of the Wild, where big Zelda music head. I've been to the Sydney Symphony's rendition of I Cried My Eyes Out. I had a had a whole moment. I love the Zelda music. And with Breath of the Wild, I understood that it was intentional, that it was supposed to be sparse and it was supposed to be certain moments. It didn't stick with me, but for me personally, I didn't think it was because there was so little of it. Because what Zelda and Zelda music has always been to me and what made me think it was memorable was its interactivity and its importance as a gameplay mechanic.
Yeah.
Because for so long, with the home console games specifically, music was such an important part of the gameplay. What with your Ocarina, with your Wind Waker, like playing music for things to happen, in my eyes, made that music memorable because you needed it in the game. And so that, for me, I guess with Zelda, that was what made it memorable. It's kind of like, I wouldn't call it a hot take, but like I would consider it an opinion that maybe other people would be like, oh no, it's just because it's good. And it's like, yeah, Koji Kondo's a genius, obviously. I feel like a big part of the memorability of Zelda music is because you were playing those tunes over and over and over again to make things happen in the game, right?
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I mean, Ocarina of Time was the first Zelda that I played. And I've been a massive fan of the series ever since. I've gone backwards, I've gone forwards. I think I've played them all by this point. But I agree that ever since that moment in Majora's Mask, I've been searching for the instrument that I get to play again. And the instrument with freedom, because there's the wand in Wind Waker, which is good, but it doesn't give you that same, you know, there was a real one-to-one play, right? Like between what you were doing with your fingers on the controller and what the instrument was doing in Ocarina.
Totally.
Which I haven't got really since, and in very few games since. And, you know, I think it's actually really beautiful in that sense to think of, I mean, weirdly enough, languages seems to be a theme of our chat today, but like, you know, English is actually one of the few languages that has play in such a broad sense. You know, you play a sport, you play a game, you play music. A lot of other languages, including Portuguese, distinguish between those different types of play as different words. And I think, you know, to think about what a video game is doing, what you're doing when you're playing a video game as play, it helps break down those boundaries as something that you're actually doing with your fingers on the controller. You're playing an instrument. And, you know, those melodies are, as I'm sure it sounds like they are for you, it's so deeply embedded in my brain.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Even now I can think of like my muscle memory is spot on there to play like the Song of Storms on the N64 controller. Where was I even going with this? Yeah, but I agree that like that sense of play, I look for it in every Zelda game, and I still haven't found it since. And I really hope that they do that in the future, because it was such a beautiful little thing. And it was also like, you know, that was the era where Nintendo was exploring the possibilities of controllers, which they still do. The Switch is, you know, much more that than any of the other consoles available at the moment, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, think back to, like, Super Mario, you know, being the flagship game for the 64, and the way that it opens with the Mario's face that you can kind of warp and move, because it's teaching teaching you how to use the controller. Which, by the way, is another thing that I think is totally overlooked in games history. How much video games have been used consciously as a tool to teach us how to use computers, and how to kind of like domesticate, I mean that literally, domesticate technological devices, right? Make them part of the home. Because in the 80s, it was very much like, you know, if you're a middle-class family, do you buy a microwave or a color TV perhaps? Or maybe you can buy a computer, but what do you do with a computer? Well, there are all these like serious reasons. You might do a spreadsheet, right? Like, I don't know what that spreadsheet would be for. Well, in the 80s, you wouldn't do an email.
I wasn't alive.
Wow, sadly I was. But
I don't know about it.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, because that's the thing, right? It wasn't connected to the internet. So it wasn't a communication tool at all, right? So it wasn't like you could get home and just like download work onto it and keep working. It had to be a very self-contained thing. There are these ads from that era for what they call microcomputers. They weren't, because computers were usually the size of rooms, right? So home computer was a microcomputer. And it's like, well, you might store recipes on it. You might do a spreadsheet. Don't really know why, but you might, maybe like home finances or something like that. But most importantly, and really what everybody used them for, was you might play a game.
Yeah.
And that taught you how to navigate user interface, how to do file systems, how to use a mouse, how to use a keyboard, how to type. Games are such a huge part of that story, and that's actually very rarely commented on. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, it was a total digression. The whole thing's been a digression.
But you're right. Like games, despite still being considered like a weird niche, there's also so many ways in which they're so ingrained in how we've kind of grown our relationship with tech. It's fascinating. But this episode is about music.
Yes, so
we
do sorry.
Have to get back. No, it's so fine. As we were talking about Zelda, like, it was a very weird thing when I think the last home Zelda game to have an instrument that you play, I might be wrong, I'm pretty sure it was Twilight Princess, but it might have been Skyward Sword. But I remember playing Breath of the Wild and being like, oh, where's my instrument? And because I was under the impression throughout that whole experience that Zelda games were music games. Like that was a big theme in the games, was that you'd play music. Because I had played, you know, I'd played Ocarina of Time, I'd played Majora's Mask, I played Wind Waker, and I played these and were like, yeah, you always have an instrument, because playing music is just a thing that Link does.
Yeah.
Apparently not. Apparently that wasn't a really important part, which I always found really funny. But, you know, actually, I do want to ask as well, because I think, you know, you've obviously got a lot of knowledge when it comes to video game soundtracks, but you've also got a lot of knowledge when it comes to film soundtracks as well. I feel like movies and video games kind of have those memorable musical moments in actually very different ways, but I can't vocalize it. So what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, so film music as well, I think, has been moving away from the really big melody to the point where, like, the Avengers really didn't have that memorable theme up until the Avengers, right? The first few Iron Man movies, like, no offense to their composers, I'm sure it wasn't their fault. It was the producer's direction. Don't really have memorable melodies, or really particularly even memorable sounds. They are superhero music, and that kind of works for the genre. I would go as far as saying that it's not really up until a film like Black Panther that you get really, really memorable Marvel music, and that is a real standout. And this is not because the composers aren't talented, or because they forgot. It's because that is the trend of film music these days. You know, I teach film music at Swinburne University, where I work. And, you know, like a lot of the students really remark on how, you know, when I play them an older movie, even like Star Wars. I remember years ago, I had a student who was just like, I just can't cope watching the original Star Wars because it's like I've got like a little bee in my ear that's just like telling me the narrative, you know? And I can't switch it off. I can't escape this incessant music, which was wild for me to consider at the time, because for me, Star Wars is like my, you know, bread and butter. That's the thing that I grew up loving. And that style of music in particular, that style of soundtrack in particular, is what I find closest to my heart. But I think, you know, today, you know, maybe there's been a little bit of a turn back in the last few years, but still not enough. Like over the last 20 years, it's really lent towards, you know, what you might call kind of musical landscape, atmospheres, techniques. Like a composer like Hans Zimmer loves a technique. And I think, you know, a composer like Hans Zimmer has really perfected, as much as I love him, has really perfected the press anecdote. Every time he's got a new project coming out, it's like, here's the little story about how this was created. That frames everything. Like I noticed the other day, you know, they're talking about Dune 3. And I saw an interview where it was like, I'm already writing music for it because Denis, the director, Denis Villeneuve, wordlessly walked over to my desk and placed the book on it. And like, I was like, man, I'm going to hear that anecdote every interview for like the next 5 years.
Well, everybody loves a story, you know? And I feel like it's those stories that obviously your work as well, but like, it's those stories that kind of make you marketable as a great composer, right?
For sure. I think, you know, to his credit, that is absolutely what Hans Zimmer has pioneered. I don't think cynically. I think it sort of comes naturally to him. Oh, no, it's masterful. Yeah. But, yeah, anyway, so I think, you know, soundtracks today are much more about creating a mood. A mood is still so incredibly important. It doesn't matter what notes are being played, and I think, you know, notes are incredibly important, but in terms of the impact, I mean to say I think melody is incredibly important, but
I'm just going to say I love musical notes.
Yeah. what a ridiculous thing for me to say. But, you know, mood is so shaped by music. One of the kind of ways that I put this to students is that there are so many different meanings in any given bit of screen content, whether it's a video game or a film, you know, the moving image. You can show something and imagine I'm showing you a beach scene, right? There are palm trees, maybe a coconut, the water is lulling beautifully, whatever. You put a ukulele underneath that and it's kind of a holiday scene. You put Jaws underneath that and it's suddenly terrifying. And both of those possibilities are in the image. It could be a holiday scene. It could be a shark attack. But it's the music that lets us know what to feel and, you know, which one of those meanings is locked into the image. So I think, you know, mood today is still incredibly important. You could probably show a clip of Arrakis and put that same holiday Hawaiian music underneath and suddenly it's a wonderful desert oasis escape, right? But
suddenly I'm watching Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But Hans Zimmer, you know, gives us something completely different and that really helps give these films, I think, a sense of occasion and largeness, I think, in particular, is what his music brings to it. And video games have really gone down that path too. I think getting that cinematic sound, I mean, that's a whole other conversation as well, is the fact that for a very long time, video games kind of looked to cinema as like the goal. And that included emulating Hollywood style music as being the goal.
So I'll quickly ask my final question, and it's the worst question in the world. What is your favorite video game soundtrack? Sorry.
No, it's a great question. Man, I mean, look, I often would actually say, I don't know, some kind of Zelda, and I still strongly feel that. But I think actually, you know, that comment about video games drawing on film soundtracks, you know, it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. And I know there's a lot of debate about L.A. Noire, but I think one thing you can't deny is that it had an amazing film noir inspired soundtrack drawing on everything from Double Indemnity to Elevator to the Gallows and Taxi Driver and Chinatown, huge influence, Chinatown and L.A. Confidential. It's got a great soundtrack, and it's something that I think has stayed with me long after the game did as well. So I don't know. I'll give that answer today, and next time you ask me, I'll give you a different one.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Absolute pleasure.
Where can we find more of your work?
Great question, because I would usually say the Good Ship Twitter, but I think that's...
Are you still there?
No, look, my account's still there and I definitely lurk, but I haven't tweeted since like January, I think, and I'm getting pretty good at that. Yeah. I mean, you can definitely find my website, dangolding.com, and I've endeavored to do like the newsletter thing, of which I've only done one so far, but I've got another one coming. So I'll do like little announcements and stuff there, but my website, some of the concerts that we do with Art of the Score should be listed there, and games, obviously, when they come out, soundtracks, I make a song and dance about through there, so for sure. Or come study with me at Swinburne Uni.
Yeah, good on Dan. Thank you so much again for joining me on the show today.
My pleasure, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And a big thank you to you for listening. If you're liking what you're hearing and you'd like to hear more, consider supporting Backpocket over on Patreon. If you support us at the silver tier and above, you can get access to our bonus episodes. In this week's bonus episode, we're avoiding the DMCA Pocket Buds edition with Gus. Here's a sneak peek.
Okay. Yep. I can hear that now.
Wait. No.
That's that theme?
And hey, if you really like what you're hearing, why not give us a 5-star rating on whatever podcast platform you're using? Better yet, why not give us a nice little review on Apple Podcasts? You can also find us on Twitch, where we've got our main live show every Thursday from 7 p.m, and on TikTok, where we're constantly posting very good stuff for you to cast your big, beautiful eyes on. And then there's the socials, like Twitter and Threads and whatnot, which you're also welcome to get around. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in, and as a sentient video game trumpet would say, bye!
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.